at the letters for Wednesday, March 6th, 2024. Arden Zwelling with Ben Nicholson Smith, our producer this week, filling in for Christian Ryan, is Showally. Many thanks to him for stepping up and filling in. You'll hear him on Jays Talk. For now, Ben and I are gonna recount what's going on in Blue Jays camp because there is much to discuss. And last time we did this, Ben, I'd been in camp for like a week, so you kind of put it to me, hey, what are you seeing, what do you know, what's happening, what's sticking out to you, what's on your mind? Now here we are, I'm still in camp, but you have been in camp for a week, so how about I turn the tables on you and ask you, what are your observations so far from Blue Jays spring training?
Well, it's great to be down here, of course. Definitely appreciate just being around baseball. And, you know, this team is interesting. When I first got here, I was thinking, man, they look pretty good. They're in a good position. And this is a team that is every bit as good as the Rays and can really threaten with the Orioles. And who knows, maybe even with the Yankees. Since then, there have been a couple developments. Man, it has been a tough week for the Blue Jays, and so we'll get into all that. But, you know, just really broadly, yeah, it's great to be down here. There's so many familiar faces. It's, of course, people within the organization, not just players, not just coaches, but, you know, you have all kinds of staff. It's such a big operation here. Many of those people you and I know, Arden, of course. And then it's not just people in the Blue Jays organization. It's running into scouts from other teams, executives from other teams. It's running into writers who cover the sport nationally or cover the different teams here in the Grapefruit League. So, you know, you really do get the chance to have a lot of different conversations and then very quickly broaden the scope of, you know, how I'm looking at the game. So it's been great. I feel like it's been a really productive week. It's so fun to be down here kind of creatively having the chance to tell some cool stories and talk to lots of people. So off to a great start personally. And yeah, unfortunately for the Jays, not the greatest week for them.
Yeah, it's cool to kind of see what's changed, what's developed, what's progressed, like over the last, whatever it's been, 3 months, 3.5 months since like we were both around the team, because, you know, it's like, oh, hey, Mitch White's velo is a lot different than last time we saw him. Or, oh, hey, like Jose Berríos has this new weapon against lefties. Oh, Nate Pearson's splitter is looking like a really good pitch. Like all kinds of things like that. Players who maybe weren't as much on our radar towards the end of last year who all of a sudden are. Like the name Ernie Clement like keeps coming up. Like one of my favorite things to do at this time of camp is just whoever's kind of around BP or whoever I bump into who's with the team in whatever capacity, I kind of go, hey, who do you like? Like, who's the dark horse? Who's a sleeper? Who's a pick to click? Like, you know, who's somebody who's standing out in camp? And the name Ernie Clement has come up multiple times. And I'm not going up and saying, hey, tell me about Ernie Clement. Like, this is people who are bringing him up to me. That tells me something. So that type of stuff is really invigorating at this time of year. I'm sure we're probably only days away from spring training feeling like a bit of a grind again to the kind of the dead zone of camp a little bit when all the stories have been told and all the players are kind of sick of it and ready to get the hell out of Florida and start playing games that matter. But at this point, I do feel like there is still quite a lot of new information to uncover. So that's pretty fun.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure I know the players obviously do get tired of it at a certain point. It gets a little repetitive, but I'm not tired of it, that's for sure. I think there's so much to kind of watch and learn here. Just on Ernie Clement, it's funny, right? Because, like, you know, internally, he has his supporters, right, within the Jays. But even I was hearing from some people with other teams that if Ernie Clement hits the waiver wire, they're like, yeah, we'd want him. We think he's a big league player. And they think that the Jays may well hold on to him, keep him as depth behind Bo Bichette just in case, have him as depth in the middle of that infield should they need it. But this is a guy who other teams are watching as one of those fringe type players who could be pushed off a roster, and other teams like this guy.
Ernie is the talk of Grapefruit League. Yeah. That is what we're finding here. But look, like you could see it, right? The Blue Jays really do like him, and they like that he makes a ton of contact. You can't get any pitch by him. And like that's clearly something the Blue Jays have prioritized in their roster construction this year. Low strikeout rate, high contact, guys who can spoil pitches, guys who are going to work deeper plate appearances. Ernie Clement like can definitely do that for you. area. He can also pick it at shortstop and play a variety of other positions. He's fast, which the Blue Jays like, and he's really accepting of what his role would and will or would, whichever way we're going here, be on this team. Like, he's not somebody who is going to be particularly put off by maybe only playing two or three times a week and who might be playing a different position every time that he's in and might be pinched running one day and not playing for 2 days and then starting at shortstop the day after that. Like, he's somebody who's just very comfortable with the uncertainty of that role and who really embraces it and brings just the same level of compete no matter how or when or why he's in the lineup. And then there's the clubhouse stuff as well. Like, he is just a really positive presence, an uplifting guy, you know, a real like source of energy on a daily basis. The Blue Jays like all of those things about him. So like, if we were breaking camp tomorrow, I would have Ernie Clement on the Blue Jays bench.
I would too, for sure. I would think that he's on there in some capacity. One other just big picture note here, because I forget this every spring, because as the season progresses, you know, the atmosphere around the team changes gradually, and there are more fans, and you get to the playoffs, and it's louder and louder and louder, and then you dial it back, and you restart the next spring, and there's kind of no one around. And so I always forget, like, how cool it is to be at these games sometimes, like yesterday, lovely Bradenton, Florida, watching the Blue Jays and the Pirates, and, like, you can hear the player sliding into second base from where I'm sitting in the press box, and you can hear the outfielders calling for the ball. So it just gives you like a really cool level of access that, you know, brings you closer to the game. And it's a fun time of year for that reason.
Well, and this is a digression, but I know that you feel similarly to me. How good is it to just watch a sim game on a backfield?
Oh yeah. I'm here for the sim games.
Completely earnestly. Let me cover 162 sim games rather than 162 regular season games. Like, it's just such a cool atmosphere and experience. So Ben and I are at Yusei Kikuchi and Ricky Tiedemann's sim game on, I want to say it was Sunday. The days all kind of blend together at this point. Kikuchi's got the sim game. Tiedemann's more so just like a live batting practice scenario. So he doesn't have like a full defense behind him, but Kikuchi does. And it's just, it's us, it's Blue Jays front office folks, it's coaches and other players, and that's it. And it is just like, it is quiet, it's intense, everyone is really locked in. You can like hear what Isaiah Kiner-Falefa is saying at the plate as he like measures up Ricky Tiedemann's slider, or what, you know, Dalton Varsho is saying after he takes one or whiffs at one. You can hear Pete Walker like calling balls and strikes from behind the plate. It's just like a really, really cool atmosphere and environment, and you get like an amazing view of just what Ricky Tiedemann's stuff is doing and just his metal and like composure and approach on the mound. Like, you just don't get to see these guys competing in as intimate of an environment during the regular season and during actual games. It's a really cool atmosphere.
It's honestly so cool. And yeah, sim games, for the record, I would take sim games every day of spring in the regular season. We had this debate on Sunday. In the regular season, I want real games. Like, I want actual games. But in the springtime, a sim game it's amazing. Like, that the intimacy of it and just like getting to be that close to it. And also, it's really about the process of it. It's not, you're not worried too much of would that ball have been caught in the gap. It's just, all right, that was hit hard, he executed the changeup or he didn't, and you kind of go from there. But it's incredibly cool. I don't know about you, like, I feel like I learned something about Ricky Tiedemann in that start.
What'd you learn?
I think his fastball is electric. I mean, that's not necessarily new information, but
you didn't know that?
That's you see news that to you? Firsthand, it reinforces it, right? 95, 97, locating it over the heart of the plate for strikes, challenging big league hitters with it, and getting awkward swings, getting ill-timed swings against guys who get results at the highest level offensively. I mean, that's a big league fastball. It plays right now. There's nothing more that he needs out of that fastball. To me, the slider, he isn't locating it quite as precisely, quite as finely as you would want for a big league pitcher, and that's fine. He's rehabbing. He's a prospect. That's what you'd expect, and he's still working to develop feel for that changeup, but the fastball is a big league fastball right now.
Yeah.
To hear Yusei Kikuchi saying afterwards that he's jealous of Ricky Tiedemann's stuff, as if Yusei Kikuchi isn't like a left-handed starter at the big league level whose fastball sits in the mid-90s and who has like a slider that had like a +8 run value last year. To hear him being like, no, I'm jealous of that kid, that kind of says something.
It really does. So yeah, really cool to be in this environment for those types of moments. So many different subplots. I think that's the one thing too that you're reminded of when you're down here, because they're just layers to it. It's the Ricky Tiedemann trying to build up, and then you have the big leaguers, and then you have prospects even lower in the organization than a Tiedemann that we have the chance to watch at times. So you really do get a sense of the entire organization.
Yeah, and it's just cool how like all the other kind of big leaguers who weren't on the trip, and I mean very few of them were, it was like a Sunday to Fort Myers, but we're just like hanging out around this sim game as well. Yeah. And like Alec Manoah is like getting involved in, you know, where Pete Walker talking to say Ricky in between their innings, and you know, everybody's kind of just like hushed, and there's like a ton of big leaguers who are just sitting down behind the plate just to get a better look at it, and just like the very like quiet ambiance of it. Like I was talking to Joe Siddle during one of his innings, and we were kind of like trying to predict what pitch he was going to throw next, and we were reacting to like just the sequencing and the strategy, and I kind of realized at one point like, oh, like we need to kind of whisper here, because like you say, yeah, could probably hear us like trying to say he's gonna throw a slider here.
Oh,
he's
for
gonna
sure
throw his changeup.
It's that quiet, right? Like you actually have to whisper. I don't think I said a single word to anyone the entire time. I was just like locked in taking notes, because you know, it's and there wasn't music playing. It was just super, super quiet, and the focus is absolutely on baseball.
You were peeking over shoulders at radar guns, and
didn't have to.
You were trying to, you know, look over at the TrackMan data on the laptop.
It was broken.
I know what you were doing.
I think it was down.
I know. Yeah. Yeah, it seemed like it. I did need TrackMan to tell that you know, Yusei Kikuchi and Ricky Tiedemann can definitely get some whiffs at the big league level. But look, we've gone on long enough about side sessions and about sim games. We got to talk about this Blue Jays rotation and what is happening right now with Kevin Gausman and Alec Manoah, who are both battling shoulder issues. Notice I did not say injuries, because the Blue Jays have been very clear. The Blue Jays have been very clear. These are not injuries. For Manoah, it has been referred to as soreness in his shoulder. And for Gausman, is being described as general fatigue in his shoulder. So neither of them have been off a mound this week. This is the stuff that kind of cropped up during bullpens over the weekend. They're both playing catch from flat ground right now at the Blue Jays complex in Dunedin. You know, I imagine we're going to find out some more about this on Thursday. We're recording this on Wednesday, March 6th. So the Blue Jays are off. We don't have access to the facilities. There's no avails. There should be fresh information on this on Thursday. But Ben, I mean, we are 3 weeks from opening day, and neither Kevin Gausman nor Alec Manoah are throwing off of a mound to this point in the week. How does the club manage this going forward?
Well, it's not good, right? This is, like you said, 3 weeks away, and there's a reason that spring training is so long. It is long for pitchers, and it is long because it takes a long time for these guys to get built up from throwing off flat ground to throwing off a mound for 5-6 ups. You're talking 75 to 90 pitches minimum to open the season as a starting pitcher. So that tells me, injury or not, call it whatever you like, and it's a good thing for the Blue Jays and Manoah and Gausman that there is not structural damage right now, but this is going to be a real challenge to get one or both of these guys ready for opening day. If all goes well, maybe they can be ready for opening day as like the number 4 or 5 starter in the rotation, stretched out to 75-90 pitches. That would be a best case scenario. But the more I look at this, the more likely it is that at least one, maybe two of those guys are not ready to open the season. And that means Bowden Francis and maybe Mitch White. And that is not ideal for a team that doesn't have a huge amount of margin for error.
Yeah, I should have mentioned they both had MRIs, which according to the Blue Jays did not reveal any structural concerns. So yeah, that's positive. But you just look at the calendar and you just kind of play it out based on how we know the Blue Jays like to progress pitchers. So, if they're both throwing off flat ground here in the middle of the week, say they get into a side session Friday at the earliest, Saturday, somewhere around there. Then you need a couple days off from there. Then it's a live bullpen. You get back to facing hitters. You don't just go straight from the side session into a game. So yeah, the live bullpen, maybe a week of the 11th at the earliest, like probably even the middle of that week, the Tuesday or the Wednesday. So you're now looking at like the 12th or the 13th. And if that side session goes well, that live bullpen goes well, couple days off after that, maybe even three. And so now you're looking at into like the weekend of the 16th, 17th at the earliest that they get into a game. And we'll see like how built up they are at that point. Is it like a 20 pitch thing? Could it be a 35 pitch thing? How deep could they go in that appearance? And then you take your 4 days off, you get back on a mound. We're now into like late the week of the 18th. We're now looking at like the 21st or the 22nd, somewhere in there for their second outing here, assuming no setbacks and assuming everything's great. And then like 4 to 5 days after that, oh, hey, it's the regular season already.
Yeah.
So realistically, like best case scenario at this point, one of these guys is able to be like the number four in your rotation or the number five coming out of the gate to start the regular season. Remember, the Blue Jays don't have that like second day of the year off day that you sometimes see. They're starting in a dome stadium. They're starting in two covered stadiums with Tampa Bay and Houston. So they don't need that kind of inclement weather safeguard. So the Blue Jays start with like games on seven straight days, so they're going to need a full rotation. They're going to need five guys. So maybe Kevin Gausman can start like the fourth or fifth day of the season and go 80 pitches. But that's like honestly best case scenario if everything is absolutely smooth and hunky-dory from now towards opening day.
Yeah, I mean, that is how I see it as well. It is becoming very, very difficult to the point of being impossible to imagine that Kevin Gausman could start on opening day. And this is a guy obviously finished third in Cy Young voting last year. In a normal season, he'd be your opening day starter. He's been great for the Blue Jays the last 2 years. That option, based on what you just outlined right there, it just seems to be off the table. Now, you got to play the long game. No one's saying that you should rush him to be ready. You got to let him recover at whatever pace makes sense. But you have to look at someone else. So maybe it's Jose Berríos. We mapped it out the other day in Bradenton. Berríos, without too many adjustments, could start opening day for the Jays against Tampa Bay. But that is even the optimistic reading, right? So there's also a scenario where even, let's say, like a slightly less optimistic reading, but still not a doomsday scenario, would be they need even a little bit more time. And it doesn't go, because what you outlined is kind of the best case scenario. So let's say they need a little bit more time to progress, and they're going to have to start the season on the injured list, but they're going to be ready by, you know, the second week of the season, something like that. That would be far from catastrophic. In fact, if you could snap your fingers as the Blue Jays right now and do that, I think you would. In that scenario, you need Bowden Francis ready. You need probably someone else. So it probably is a Mitch White, or it probably is it Chad Dallas or Wes Parsons, or somebody might have to be in that number five spot. So you're really getting down the depth chart. And I think Bowden Francis is a great number six, but I don't know that they have a great number seven.
Yeah, I agree with you. This is where, you know, at least the Blue Jays feel better about their starting pitching depth this year than they did last. Because last year breaking camp, it was like Drew Hutchison and Zach Thompson in the roles that right now we're seeing Bowden Francis and Mitch White in. And there is a very big difference between, you know, Zach Thompson trying to like kitchen sink it with five different pitches and Drew Hutchison being Drew Hutchison versus Bowden Francis in the form that we've seen from him this spring. Yeah. And the velo and landing the curveball and the composure and just the like real attack mentality. Like, this is a guy who is throwing every single pitch like it's 0-2. And then Mitch White as well, who has been up to 98 with his fastball and is mixing in like three off-speed secondary weapons and absolutely needs to be better at throwing strikes with those three secondaries, and particularly with putting hitters away with two strikes. But I think you feel better about those guys as your 6 and 7 than you did about the guys who are your 6 and 7 breaking camp at this time last year. So it's, the Blue Jays are in a better position depth wise on the starting front. If those, you know, if it's like Bowden Francis and Mitch White are starting in the opening week of the season, but I mean, to have your depth tested in this way, this early in the season, yeah, it is concerning, because like you're going to have to go further down that depth chart at some point. Other people are going to get hurt, and other people are going to underperform, and other people are going to need time on the IL for a multitude of reasons. And you're going to very quickly then get into the Wes Parsons of this world. And these are just really unproven options at the big league level.
Right. And it also means, like, if you're, let's say you go to Mitch White in the number 5 spot, you know, against Houston, which, you know, that's a tough lineup. But let's say he's in there. Okay, so he's stretched out to 5 innings. He was up to 38 pitches, I want to say, the other day, but felt good, on track to be stretched out to about 5 innings after pitching 3 on Tuesday. So great, he's in the rotation for 5, but it's still not 7, which you might get from Kevin Gausman, right? Like, it's still going to put more stress on the bullpen. And there might be outings where Bowden Francis or Mitch White or somebody else goes 3 1/3. And then you're stressing your bullpen more out of the gate. So that's not ideal. And it should just be mentioned, too, like Yuriel Rodriguez, who's obviously the biggest signing the Blue Jays made this offseason, he's progressing slowly and deliberately as well. So he's probably not an option for opening day. He's probably not an option to be a rotation candidate anytime soon. And Ricky Tiedemann, who, you know, again, looks electric off a mound, A, he's a prospect. He's going to start in the minor leagues. And B, he's working back from an injury of his own. So it's not as though you can dip into the minors and just snap your fingers and say, here's Yuriel Rodriguez or here's your Ricky Tiedemann.
No, it'd be more so here's Paolo Espino. Is what it would be.
I mean
that's the position the Blue Jays are in. I mean, I know this is kind of a dour painting of the picture that we're presenting here in early March before there's even been a regular season game played, but it's kind of the reality with the Blue Jays. Like you mentioned, like Yuriel Rodriguez and Ricky Tiedemann, even put aside the injury stuff, those guys were going to be brought along slowly regardless for different reasons, right? Like Rodriguez, because he did not pitch competitively after the WBC in 2023. So the Blue Jays were always going to build them up deliberately and be cautious there. And then Ricky Tiedemann, coming off of a 2023 when he missed substantial time due to injuries and did not build that like workload base that the Blue Jays wanted him to. He didn't have that platform year that they were anticipating him having in 2023. So the Blue Jays were also going to be cautious with Tiedemann's workload and kind of bring him along slowly this year. So like for a ton of reasons, there is a lot riding on the statuses of Kevin Gausman and Alek Manoah this week and for the rest of spring and early in the season. And look, there's no reason not to be optimistic about their situations. Like the Blue Jays aren't saying that there's an injury there. They're telling us about, you know, MRIs that aren't revealing anything. Both guys are thrown off flat ground this week on like subsequent days. So that wouldn't be happening if they started throwing again and there was still an issue there, or they started throwing again and there was a reason for them to be like, I can't really push this right now. So that's positive news. This is not how you want to be starting the season. I'll say that.
This is a real test. This is the biggest test, obviously, that they've encountered this spring. And it happened pretty quickly in the span of a few days where, you know, again, rotation depth is a strength of this team. So if Bowden Francis has to open, that's a way better number 6 starter than a lot of teams. And they would be okay. They could figure it out. They could compete. But Kevin Gausman's really good. Like, this is the thing. Like, even if we're optimistic about Bowden Francis, like I believe, having watched him and spoken to people and looking at the numbers, like this guy is a major league pitcher. Great. That might mean that he's a 4.25 ERA for 125 innings. That would be like amazing for the Jays if he did that this year. Kevin Gausman, though, this is someone who's literally one of the best pitchers in baseball when he's healthy. Like, he's nasty. I don't have to tell Blue Jays fans this. Kevin Gausman's as good as it gets. So whoever's replacing him, if it is for a couple weeks, if it is for a start or whatever period of time it is, if he's sidelined, that is a really, really good pitcher that's impossible to replace.
And there's trickle-down impact as well, because as you said, like, the Blue Jays are going to be relying on their bullpen a lot in that opening week of the season. They probably would have regardless, because typically the first week of the season, like, starting pitchers aren't built all the way up. So, like, you might even, if Jose Berríos starts opening day, like, he might be capped at, like, 90 pitches, even though he's probably one of the more built-up guys in camp. Like, typically you see that first start of the regular season be a little bit cautious from a workload standpoint, and not, like, necessarily a situation where it's, oh, hey, Chris Bassett's going to go out and, like, throw 115 today. It's more so, like, 90, 95 at the most. So you're going to be using your bullpen to cover there. And also, if Bowden Francis or Mitch White are starting, I would wager that the Blue Jays don't have a ton of faith in those guys a third trip through. They'll like them one trip through, one and a half, sure, but then if the matchups start getting dicey that second trip through, you might see John Schneider going to the bullpen early. Regardless, I mean, two trips and out, I think, for those two guys, because, like, you know, with Mitch White, like, he's just had trouble putting guys away with two strikes. And we've yet to see how, like, the velo maintains, like, really deeper into outings. He was really efficient his last time out, so we didn't get to see, like, how it held up towards 45-50 pitches. And then with Bowden Francis, like, that's one of his biggest things, is that the stuff has tended to drop off deeper into his outings. I mean,
right.
One inning, two inning, great, but three innings, four innings, the stuff hasn't necessarily carried that deep. And that's something the Blue Jays have challenged him with in this camp, is like, hey, prove that you can carry your stuff, and, like, prove that you can maintain that deeper into your outings, so that, like, we can trust you to go five innings as a starter. And that's something that he still has to show. So the Blue Jays bullpen, like, is going to be pitching a lot in that opening week of the season. You're going to see a lot of Chad Green and Jimmy Garcia and Tim Mayza and Jordan Romano. And if Eric Swanson is there, Eric Swanson, but obviously there are also questions around Eric Swanson's availability, because with the terrible situation that he and his family have been dealing with after his son Toby was struck by an SUV on Clearwater Beach, we haven't seen him in games, and we aren't sure what his status is or just where he's at in terms of throwing. So his availability for opening day is also, unfortunately, in question right now.
It's a little bit of a dour picture that we're painting here, but I'm not sure how to present it any other way. I'm not going to try to sit here and tell Jays fans that they should be happy with this, right? Like, it's just, if you have a Cy Young finalist go down, well, actually two Cy Young finalists, Manoah in 2022, obviously wasn't anywhere close to that last year, but you have these guys go down temporarily, but they're sidelined, they're delayed, whatever you want to call it, they're not pitching off a mound. It's just not good. So not to say they can't recover, not to say that, you know, we're not super intrigued to see where this all leads. And who knows, the Jays could still go out there and start the season 16-7 like it's baseball and strange things happen. But yeah, objectively, it is not a good situation.
But it's also not unique, is the other thing, because, like, this is happening in camps across baseball right now. As we've said, like, nothing good happens after spring training starts. Like, spring training is really about trying to avoid bad things happening, but bad things are going to happen. And every team across the big leagues right now is dealing with somebody whose shoulder is barking or who pulled a hammy. Or if you're the Red Sox, it's like Lucas Giolito is all of a sudden not even available at all this year. You know, if, like, the Tampa Bay Rays certainly aren't going to be feeling bad for the Blue Jays right now after last year they lost Drew Rasmussen and Jeffrey Springs and Shane McClanahan and had to, like, piece together rotation and still found a way to win 99 games. Like, the Blue Jays were really spoiled last year with the health and the durability and the consistency that they had, particularly in the starting rotations. So in a lot of ways, they are really right now just facing the adversity and challenges that 29 other teams are quite accustomed to.
Yeah, it's part of the challenge of Major League Baseball. This is where the Jays' depth will be tested, and if they've done a good enough job of finding and developing depth players, then they'll be able to overcome this. And if they haven't, then they won't. It's really that simple. I mean, guys like Mitch White and Bowden Francis, they've been in this organization now for a little while, and this might be their time to shine. And the same goes on the position player side, where guys will get opportunities. Maybe it isn't Ernie Clement or somebody else, but yeah, this is it's the depth that distinguishes the you know, well, it's also the top end talent, but you know, the depth can play a huge role. And so that's an opportunity right here for some of those Jays players.
An opportunity right here for us to step away, but when we come back, we should talk about the position player side of things and some other stuff that Ben and I have been noticing around camp over the last couple of weeks. All that and so much more when we continue on At The Letters.
Listen to At The Letters ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
It continues on At The Letters. Arden Zwelling and Ben Nicholson-Smith, our producer this week, is Sho Ali. Thanks to him for his work on this episode, and sorry to him for having to endure how dour that first half of the podcast was. Things aren't supposed to be this dispiriting in spring, Ben. This is supposed to be about optimism and possibilities, and good things could happen. Your team is going to win it all. They're going to go all the way. Every player is going to be great. Everyone's in the best shape of their life. No one's in a slump yet. No one's lost a game yet. Everything is roses. So Ben, I'm going to challenge you right now. Say something positive about the Blue Jays. What are you most optimistic about with this club? What have you seen over the last week that has given you the most reason to believe good things are ahead for the Blue Jays?
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, definitely don't want to sit here and tell Blue Jays fans to be happy with, you know, a spring that so far has had some pretty tough development. But within that, yeah, there are some really encouraging developments here. And it actually does tie to the pitching. Like, I think that when you have Mitch White throwing 98 and when you have Bowden Francis just really shoving and throwing up to 97 miles an hour and turning over big league lineups consistently, that is really encouraging. That's got to be a big positive for the Jays when you see Vlad Jr. stepping in there and just destroying baseballs into the batter's eye, sending it deep over the center field wall at TD Ballpark in Dunedin. That's obviously an encouraging development for the Blue Jays. Yeah, I think that even seeing Justin Turner make consistent contact and really start to connect with the players here, you can tell he's already fitting in seamlessly, making an impact, described by some people around the team as, you know, a great leader, someone who is easy to listen to because he's done it so many times and because he continues to do it. And so it's different than hearing it from a coach, and it's certainly different from, you know, than hearing it from a front office member whose, you know, intentions are maybe good, but just doesn't have that same shared experience that Justin Turner has with these players. So I think that there are a lot of, you know, things going on that are really worth watching and could end up being real positives for this team. But those are a few that come to mind for me.
Yeah, someone put it to me the other day when we were chatting about Justin Turner. Someone said, dude, it's like we have another hitting coach. Yeah. Which, you know, the Blue Jays bordering on having more hitting coaches than hitters right now, if we're putting Justin Turner into that room as well. But yeah, he's certainly had like a profound impact so far on the Blue Jays. Like he's clearly just very comfortable and self-assured in himself and in his career and what he's here to do. Like it's really challenging going into a new environment in a new clubhouse. Like this is something I was talking to Daniel Vogelbach about recently, and you know, he's experienced it a couple times now, and he was telling me, yeah, it never gets easier because there are established rhythms and routines and relationships and things, and it is just like, it's like starting at a new school. I think that Justin Turner has honestly made it seem really seamless and really easy to just immediately take on a leadership role with this team. And I know that players and coaches alike are benefiting from that.
I think it makes a lot of sense that after all this time, there's a certain ease to it, right? It's just a little different, you know, once you get to that point in his career. He's such a veteran player, right? I mean, you hear about Josh Donaldson retiring the other day, and kudos to Josh Donaldson on a great career in the major leagues. And Justin Turner, like, he's kind of the same vintage as Donaldson. In fact, he's a year older than Josh Donaldson. So there's a lot of experience there, and I think that that makes it easier for him to sort of settle into these environments and create that comfort for himself. And then people feed off that too, because they can tell that he's comfortable, and more to the point, he's getting results. He knows how to work. He knows how to hit major league pitching. I do think that that's a positive. And Vogelbach too, right? Like, this is a guy who settles in first, or one of his first games of the spring facing Gerrit Cole, boom, over the wall, just absolutely hammers it.
Daniel Vogelbach gets a piece of that one and drills it deep to right field. A two-run shot, and the Blue Jays are on the board.
That one was supposed to be in, caught too much of the plate. Vogelbach turned on it.
Of course, Gerrit Cole didn't like it, but, you know, that's a whole other story. But I think that some of these veteran hitters are having a positive impact on the Jays, and this is candidly what they needed, right? Like, you can't have Chapman and Belt disappear and not replace them with some sort of major league caliber hitters, and I think Turner and Vogelbach are a step in the right direction there.
I think you saw the opposite end of that with Dalton Varsho a little bit last year, where he comes into a new environment and there's a lot of pressure on him because of who he was traded for and because he's like the cleanup hitter on opening day. And I think you saw his heart rate like increase a bit and him get a bit jumpy in the box. Like, it's something that he's talked about, right? Like, he put a lot of pressure on himself last year and he was really kind of chasing power at times. And he's talked about how, like, looking back, he looks back at his swings from last year and he's just like under everything. Like, he's trying to do too much. He's trying to force power and just trying to hit home runs. And like, hitters will tell you that, like, when you're trying to hit a home run, that's when you hit a pop up, or that's when you, foul something off. That's when you swing and miss and look foolish. You know, some of the best power hitters in this game will tell you, like, home runs are thrown. They're not hit. You got to let those mistakes come to you, and you have to execute your best swing and just trust that the ball will do what you need it to do if you're on time and synced up and free and easy. So, you know, I think that the Blue Jays are really encouraged with how Dalton Varsho is looking in this camp and just with how much more comfortable he is and kind of within himself he is at the plate. You know, another guy who you're hearing really good stuff about around camp right now is Vladimir Guerrero Jr. Like, the Blue Jays have addressed some stuff in his swing that was troubling him last year or limiting him perhaps at plate, like some movements that he didn't need to make, some stuff with the hands, which is what you will hear Blue Jays hitting coaches and John Schneider talk about all the time, is that with Vlad, you can kind of tell when things are going well with his swing and when things aren't by what he's doing with his hands and how quiet they are and how much they're moving. So I think the Blue Jays are really encouraged with just the work that Vlad was able to do over the offseason and how he's kind of carried over some of that swing stuff, some of that approach stuff into these Grapefruit League games. I mean, we saw him absolutely obliterate a pitch like 440 feet in Dunedin.
The 1-0. High fly ball center field, and Rojas won't even move in center. The first home run of the spring for Vladimir Guerrero Jr., and it was a bomb.
I think that the Blue Jays are pretty encouraged that Vlad is in a good place and is ready to hit the ground running for opening day.
Yeah, definitely looking good with the swings. And I also like his silver cleats. Just want to state that for the record. And his pink sunglasses. Very cool look. He got those as a gift from Alec Manoa. Silver cleats, pink shades. He's ready to roll. So, you know, that's always a good sign for the Jays. Vladdy looking really good. And I think on Varsho too, like, you know, we're talking about someone who is, in my opinion, like, probably the safest bet to bounce back offensively on this team. It's hard to match the war totals that he's had the last couple of years because he's been so good defensively, and I still think he's an elite defender. I still think he'll be really, really good. Maybe that war takes a different form this year. Maybe it's a little more offensive, and not to say that I think he's going to regress defensively, but it's a really good player. It's a really good combination. So Varsho's someone who in his second year might have a little bit less pressure. I think if he's hitting seventh for you as a, you know, 105 WRC plus who plays great defense, you're thrilled with that, right? Like that's what you look for in a deep major league lineup. Like that's the kind of production that you're trying to get. And he seems to be well positioned to do that again this year.
Another guy who, just to keep the positivity train rolling, who, you know, at least I'm hearing really good things about so far in camp is Chad Green. The Blue Jays are really happy with where he's at. And it's interesting, like, you look at last year's bullpen, and you kind of think to yourself, man, like, you know, where are the Blue Jays going to replace, like, those 30 innings they got from Jay Jackson or those, like, 30 innings they got from Jordan Hicks? Like, you know, where, you know, even we forget, but Adam Simber and Anthony Bass, like, were parts of this bullpen for the first couple of months of the season and probably got up to, like, 20, 25 innings each. So you're kind of thinking to yourself, like, where are those innings going to come from? I think Chad Green is going to provide a lot of those innings. Like, I talked to him the other day because, you know, I was curious, like, before he had Tommy John surgery, I mean, he was a guy who would regularly be up over 70 innings. He was up over 80 in 2021 with the Yankees. And I kind of asked him, like, is that still realistic coming off of Tommy John? And he looks at me, he goes, that's not just realistic. Like, that's my goal. I want to be over 80 innings again. Like, Chad Green is a guy who wants to be pitching multiple innings regularly, and the Blue Jays see him in that role as a guy who they're going to extend beyond one inning with regularity. Now, obviously, like, they're going to be mindful and careful with his arm and make sure that they're paying attention to how he's bouncing back and how he's recovering, and they don't want to abuse anybody. But Chad Green is a guy who's, like, really confident that he can carry a lot of innings, and his stuff has been really good in spring. He says he doesn't even think about his elbow on the mound anymore. He said he got to a place last year where he stopped really thinking about it, and where his command, his velo, his control, his confidence on the mound just, like, all came back and all came together, and he felt like the guy who he was before surgery. So he spent, you know, all off season, like, throwing regularly, working out a lot, like, just kind of building himself up for a heavy workload this year. I think that the Blue Jays see him as a real weapon for them, a real versatile weapon out of their bullpen.
Yeah, it's a really important player for them. And, you know, you think about this team, and it probably takes a while before you actively start thinking about Chad Green. You know, if I'm really being honest about it, I think that's probably true of a lot of fans too. But sometimes it's those players who can just provide a really high level of quiet production that end up making a big difference, right? Like, it's not all the flash that you get from Gausman's splitter or from Vladdy's home runs or from Varsho's catches even. Like, you need to have these players who can just provide some amount of steadiness. And maybe that is Bowden Francis. Maybe that is a Chad Green. You know, maybe it's IKF and he's able to go out there and give you some reasonably consistent production. He's pretty much going to be their everyday third baseman, is my read on the situation. You know, of course, Espinal can be mixed in, and Espinal actually looked really good defensively at third the other day. That's encouraging for the Jays because you want his glove to be playing up. But yeah, I think someone like IKF, if he gives you that 500 plate appearances of good defense and good base running, and he's kind of okay as a number eight hitter for you or a number nine hitter for you, then those are the types of players that aren't necessarily on the side of the stadium, but they do hold it together and just keep the team in games.
Isaiah Kiner-Falefa is pretty impressive at third base as well. Like, it's, you know, it shouldn't be a surprise. He won a gold glove there with Texas, but I mean, he has made some really nice plays at third in Grapefruit League games to this point. And like, you're right, he's going to play a ton of third this year, although wouldn't be surprised to see him at second every now and then. He could give Bo Bichette a day off at short every now and then, and he could even be in the outfield every once in a while. He's going to get some reps in the outfield before the end of camp, just so that he's at least familiar with that and so that he's done it recently. It's kind of interesting. He says that his most comfortable outfield position is center.
Yeah.
Rather than one of the corners, just because of kind of the reads and the angles. I doubt you're going to see him in center very much for the Blue Jays, but it was an interesting perspective. So it's been cool getting to know Isaiah Kiner-Falefa a little bit and getting to see his game up close a little bit. Like, I know that he is very confident that he found something offensively last year. I mean, we'll see if he's able to carry over some of the success that he was able to have from, I think it was, you know, maybe late May, early June on. Like, it was basically from, like, the day that he went deep off Kevin Gausman on. Like, he did have some good results at the plate with the Yankees, and he was, you know, it's not easy when you're in that kind of bench platoon part-time role. Like, you don't ever really get to feel a rhythm and get like a real comfort at the plate with those regular consistent reps. But Kiner Falefa feels like he's in a position to do some damage, and that, you know, mentally he's kind of found some things at the plate that he feels like he's going to be able to bring this year. So we'll see. As you said, he's somebody who's going to be playing a lot. Like, Matt Chapman is not going to be a Toronto Blue Jay, and there is not going to be a substantial addition on the position player side or the pitching side, really, but on the position player side between now and opening day. So Isaiah Kiner Falefa, Kevin Biggio, if healthy, if he's able to get in some Grapefruit League games here and get ready for the regular season, dealing with a little bit of shoulder tendonitis right now. These are guys who are positioned to see a lot of plate appearances for the Blue Jays towards the bottom of the order, and the Blue Jays are going to be relying on them to be getting on base, coming up with hits, extending innings, and turning things back over for your Springers, Bichettes, Vlads, Turners at the top.
Chapman gone. That is officially closed as a possibility. Obviously, the Blue Jays were engaged with him this offseason, as we know, and he ended up with the Giants, where he has a lot of connections from California, played for Bob Melvin before and knows Farhan Zaidi, and has, you know, lives in Arizona where the Giants train. So a lot of connections there. Really nice deal for the Giants. We'll see where that leads for Chapman. And as for Montgomery and Snell, I mean, the other Boris clients, I'm definitely not anticipating that they're Blue Jays. In my estimation, probably more likely that Montgomery ends up with the Red Sox and Snell ends up with maybe the Giants or the Angels. We'll see. You know, those are predictions at this point. It's not fact, but I certainly would be very, very, very surprised if those guys so much as have advanced conversations with the Jays.
Montgomery makes too much sense for the Red Sox. Not only just like before Giolito went down, he made sense for them, but like now that they're without Giolito, he definitely makes sense. And even like I was thinking about this a little bit earlier, you know, even if the Red Sox don't realistically believe they're going to be competitive in 2024, of course they're saying they're going to be, but I mean, realistically, it looks like a 500 team at best. And in the American League East, that is nowhere near good enough. Here's the thing. The Red Sox are going to want to be competitive in 2025. They're going to want to be competitive in 2026. Why not get ahead on some of that shopping now with Jordan Montgomery on a 2 or 3 year deal, right? So you could sign a Montgomery now, and it wouldn't just be for 24. You'd be addressing a hole in your rotation ahead of 25 and 26, because like they're going to have pending free agents, and who knows when Giolito is going to be back or how severe his injury is, like just what his future with the Red Sox holds. So Montgomery makes a ton of sense there. And with Snell, like, he makes a ton of sense for the Orioles. I don't know if they're in position to, like, I don't know if they're really interested in spending money on their team or if they'd rather just pocket it and hope that they score a billion runs and that's good enough to overcome some questions on the pitching side for them. But if I'm Baltimore and I'm looking at how things have broken for Snell and I'm looking at him likely being available on a shorter term deal, a year with an opt out, whatever, man, I think that makes all kinds of sense for Baltimore to get Snell. So that what I've just painted is like worst case scenario for Blue Jays fans is that Montgomery ends up with the Red Sox and Snell ends up with Baltimore, both those guys ending up in division.
Yeah, that would not be good. That would, well, maybe even worse still would be Snell ending up with the Yankees, which, you know, who knows. I think Snell actually still gets like a guaranteed deal of maybe 4 years, but we'll see. That's a tough one to predict. Here, let me throw something at you that might be a little bit more optimistic, because we were trending optimistic there for a moment and then we sort of spun out of control again. Who on this team do you think could be a 5-win player this year? Aside from Vladdy, obviously, Bo, those guys clearly can do it. They've done it before. But do you see anyone else in this team, or who else on this team do you see who has the upside to be like a 5-war player?
Vlad, Bo, Gausman. That's a high bar, man. 5-win player. Like, if you lowered it to like 3, 3.5, I'd be like, yeah, maybe you say Kikuchi. Like, Blue Jays folks are really positive about this year. They feel like they finally got his delivery down, like they got to a place where it's simplified and it's repeatable and he's confident in it. They got him to buy into the attack plan finally. He's throwing the pitches that they want him to be throwing. Like, it's been such a long process with him getting him to this point, but like the Blue Jays are really optimistic about Kikuchi this year. But I mean, five wins, Ben. Like I just cannot put that on anyone other than Gausman, Bichette, or Guerrero.
It's a lot. It's a lot for sure. I mean, Springer's done it before. I'm not putting that on him now. I don't think that's a reasonable expectation from him at this point in his career. I think Berríos could do it, and I think Varsho could do it. You know, if things were to really go well for those guys, I think they have the upside. It's not something they've done before, but I think, you know, Berríos, he looks dialed in. I know it's spring training. I know it's the Pirates. You don't want to read too much into this stuff, but this is a really good pitcher. I think that he has that kind of upside. And Varsho, if it were to sort of come together for him offensively and defensively, I could see that upside for him as well.
Berríos, like, I just feel like the ERA will still be kind of, you know, above 3.5. It'll be below 4, but it's likely to be above 3.5. That's just kind of the pitcher that he is. And so, like, the volume will be there in terms of innings, but I don't think that, like, the strikeouts will be there and the low ERA will be there for him to enter that, like, Gausman territory of being a 5-win player. With Varsho, like, yeah, he could have, like, that sneaky, like, Kevin Pillar 5-win season, right? Where he's, like, you know, Kevin Kiermaier gets hurt, Varsho ends up playing a ton of center field where his defense, like, really shines, and he puts together this, like, 80% defense, 20% running into, like, 28 homers 5-win season. Sure, yeah. I could see that, but I mean, there's nobody else on this roster I'd put 5 wins on. I could see 3.5 for Berríos or Kikuchi. Could see 3 for Bassett. I don't think that would be crazy.
Yeah.
On the position player side, if you get 3 from Justin Turner, you're ecstatic. Yeah. If you get 3 from George Springer, you're ecstatic.
Yep.
I just am not seeing anyone else on the position player side who would even flirt with 4, honestly.
Yeah, and I'm not saying this in a predictive sense as though, like, it's a lock, you know, they're definitely going to get there. But I think if we're talking possibility, I think Berríos has that upside. I think Varsho has that upside. And just looking back, as you shouted out Kevin Pillar there, 2015, 5.2 WAR for the Blue Jays, played in all but 3 games. I mean, that was something else. So that's kind of wild that he was that good that year.
Yeah, I mean, you look at Matt Chapman last year, right, who, like, didn't have his best year offensively, but still would have been, like, a 3.5-4-win player just based off the defense, right? Yeah. He's kind of a similar guy who, you know, is a lot of his value is in the defense. It'll be interesting to see just how his offense translates, by the way, at Oracle, right? Because, you know, he kind of, you know, made it known that he was none too happy with the way the ball was flying at Rogers Center last year. We'll see how things go on those cool nights in San Francisco. I'm very curious to see just how his season plays out and to see, like, just what, you know, if the defense truly is declining or if he's able to kind of pull it back, what he is offensively, what he looks like in that ballpark, like how much of last year was the finger issue and him trying to play through it. You know, just he really is in a situation where he's on this deal now where it's like, prove it, show us. That's kind of what MLB has said to him, like, show us that we should be paying you the way that your representation is suggesting you should be paid. So, like, I am just fascinated to watch how his season plays out.
For sure. Yeah. And he had a couple great years here in Toronto. I mean, you look at that trade, amazing trade. You know, there's no one that you're regretting out of that deal for the Blue Jays, that's for sure. But there was an opportunity to sort of bring him back in free agency. Didn't happen. So we will see how he does in San Fran.
Let me ask you this. Do you think that the Blue Jays could have taken the deal that he signed with San Francisco? So it was, what, 3 years, 54. But it's like he's basically got the player options in there. So, like, all things considered, right? $20 million first year, and then, like, the opt-in for the second year, third year, 2 years, 34. Could the Blue Jays have just, like, crossed out San Francisco Giants and written in Toronto Blue Jays and gotten Matt Chapman to sign that deal?
No.
I agree.
Yeah.
I don't think they could have. I also don't think they would have. But I also, like, I think that the price would have been different for Toronto than it was for San Francisco.
There's a lot of connection there when, again, like, he's played in the Bay Area. He knows the manager. He knows the GM intimately. He can stay at home for spring training, right? He doesn't have to go, you know, like, I'm happy to be in Florida. I really am. But for some people who maybe live in Arizona, the idea of going to Florida for 6 or 7 weeks just isn't that appealing. You can stay at home and be in Arizona. So, I think no. And there's also the ego element too, right? It's like the Jays reportedly made him a very generous offer of over $120 million. And, you know, coming back and accepting less than half of that might not feel like the move. So it might have been time for him to have a fresh start in his eyes and have a fresh start with the team that, you know, like I talked to Matt Chapman at the GM meetings, and he was there meeting with the San Francisco Giants, and they had expressed interest that day of like, day one, we are in, we want you. Not to say the Jays didn't do that, because the Jays, you know, obviously met with Scott Boras and expressed their real interest in Matt Chapman as well, as they would every winter. But the Giants were there from day one, and it's a chance to sort of shift the narrative and change the page. And it seems as though Chapman wanted that chance, and we'll see where it leads him.
Yeah, the Jays meet with Boras regularly, and they had discussions about Bellinger this offseason. And the Jays also weren't going to do the deal that you know, Bellinger ended up doing with the Cubs. But like, I think that in general, knowing how the Jays operate and knowing how they think and like what a value-oriented front office they are, I just have a hard time seeing them ever give out one of these pillow deals, a la the ones that Bellinger and Chapman signed, like the ones that Farhan Zaidi seems to have a ton of comfort giving up, like a really unusual amount of comfort, just considering his background in the game. Because like with these deals, particularly in the way that they are structured, the team is really taking on all of the risk for year two and year three with zero control over the process. So like, you think about it, the best case scenario with like a Bellinger or Chapman, if you're signing them to the deals that they signed, is that they're healthy and they perform well. Like, that's what you want, obviously. But if they do that, then they're going to opt out or not opt in Chapman's scenario, and you only have them for 1 year. But the only way that you have them beyond a year into year two and year three is if they are either injured or underperforming, because that's when they are going to take those second and third years. Like, that's the only scenario in which it's the Lucas Giolito scenario. That's how you end up having these guys for year two or year three. But the only way you have them in year two or year three is if you have them as a injured or underperforming player. So like, I'm very happy that these guys are getting the guarantees that they are. Like Chapman, even though his salary this year is less than the qualifying offer, I think that his deal is better than the qualifying offer, because he at least has those like,
yes,
2 years and $34 million or whatever that he can opt into if things go really haywire and really pear-shaped for him. So I think it's better. I think it's better to give up that $300K to get that possibility, be opened up to the possibility of year two and year three. But from the club side, I don't see a front office like the Blue Jays ever really being comfortable with these kind of deals, because you are just taking on all risk for year two and year three.
Yeah, you know, I could actually see them doing it for the right player. When I look at these deals, I think they're actually pretty, like, clearly, you know, there are a lot of different pathways, and there are a lot of different pathways to downside for the team. It could be downside after, you know, the first year it all kind of goes badly, or it could be downside in the third year. But the overall scale of the downside isn't that big, because it's only $54 million. So comparatively to, you know, 175, let's say Chapman was seeking that at the start of the offseason, you've kind of lowered the overall scale of how bad things could get by making the max commitment $54 million. Yeah, like, there's a lot of control that you're giving up to the player, but it can only go so badly from an overall risk standpoint. So I actually think these deals are reasonably team friendly, at least when compared to the type of 6-7 year guarantees where players just get the money no matter what their performance looks like.
I just see like so many pathways to bad case scenarios for the team, where like Giolito is a perfect example. Like the Red Sox would love to undo that deal. Yeah. They're going to have a hurt pitcher for, you know, a year and a half. Like, obviously, Giolito is going to opt in to his second year of that deal. Yeah. That's like the worst case scenario, is where he gets hurt in spring training. You don't even get like a month of production or 6 weeks or whatever. He doesn't just snap his UCL in the middle of May. He did in spring training. So like that's the worst case scenario. But there are a lot of those pathways to that like downside risk for the club. And like, again, I am in favor of players getting paid. Like, teams have control over the process with players for, you know, the first, I don't know, decade of their careers, as many as like 12, 13 years sometimes of their careers to begin with. So like, I am all for like players getting these guarantees and having that control and being able to kind of call their own shots a bit. I think it's great. But from purely the club perspective, I would have a hard time giving out too many of these deals if I'm just one of those really disciplined, methodical, value-oriented front offices. Like, I would have a hard time getting there. I haven't even mentioned the fact that the Giants are giving up, like, their second-round pick that ends up disappearing because they signed Chapman with the qualifying offer. So you think about, like, the slot value of that, whatever it would, I don't know, $4 million or something like that, poof, gone. Yep. Like, they're... Or that's an aggressive estimate on the slot. I don't have it in front of me, but there goes that money that you could have leveraged in the draft and that you could have used with your bonus pool. I mean, there's downside to that as well, where like your best case scenario is, I don't know, Matt Chapman has like a 3 WAR season and you only have him for a year and he goes back to market.
Yeah. And I mean, that's a pretty good case scenario. I think you're right. The teams, they've always been reticent to give up player options, and especially multiple player options. That's not control that teams want to give up. Front offices love controlling things. They love having all the different optionality in front of them. And, you know, this is how they talk, right? They talk like investment bankers, because some of them were investment bankers. And like, you know, yeah, they love all the optionality. They don't want to give it up. I agree with you that, you know, they don't want to do that. But I think at the same time, like the Rendon deal at whatever that was, 230 over 8, that comes with way more risk than the Chapman deal. And so relatively speaking, these deals, I think, if you're a big market team like the Giants or the Blue Jays, you can take those on.
The slot value of that pick, just quickly looking it up, is actually somewhere around $1.5 million. But when you actually like kind of think about it, like, remember, was it like Steve Cohen who was saying like, actually the value of like that, you know, that pick is way, way more than that, just because of the control that you have and because of, you know, the pre-arbiters that you could get right out of that player once they're playing for you. Like, all that surplus value that comes in year 1 through 3, if you say, I don't know, draft Bo Bichette in the second round, yeah, that that comes back around as well. Anyway, this is way too into the weeds, but the whole point of this is, like, you know, when you see that Matt Chapman signed for this with the Giants, and a lot of people who wanted Matt Chapman like catapulted into the middle of Lake Ontario by August last year, all of a sudden thinking that the Blue Jays offseason is an abject failure because they didn't re-sign him, I don't think that deal, the one that he signed with the Giants, was going to happen in Toronto.
No. Yeah, I agree with that. I agree. And one little trickle down from that, if I'm the Jays, JD Davis, maybe bumped a little further down the San Francisco depth chart, give him a call, see if there's a trade to be made there.
I'm an Austin Slater guy myself. But I, you know, ultimately there would have to be some sort of exchange of cash there, I would imagine. Like, JD Davis, I think, is around $7 million this year. Slater might be around 5. Like, so I don't know if that's like an Espinal going back the other way or like a Trevor Richards. You know, like, yeah, there would have to be some sort of. Yeah, there would have to be some sort of equalization of money there, just for the Blue Jays, payroll-wise. Go ahead.
Cash considerations can always be a part of the trade, too.
No, absolutely. So, like, that would be part of it. And also, like, I mean, you look at Davis, like, yeah, he's a nice player. He'd be a good fit for the Blue Jays. But, like, at $7 million, again, Blue Jays, like, very value-oriented front office, like, I don't know that they'd see a lot of value on that deal.
Well, and maybe, you know, Slater, I mean, for is a what better he does. Fit. Maybe because when you look at their outfield depth, the Jays don't have necessarily a lot of options behind their starting three, because they have a lot of infielders who could play the outfield, or super utility players like a Kevin Biggio. And then you get to Davis Schneider and Eduardo Escobar, and it's like, yeah, they don't really have a clear extra outfielder. So Slater's someone who kind of could fit from that standpoint. So maybe that's the move. Maybe Slater's the guy.
Yeah, I think so. But then, you know, San Francisco would see the value in him as well, and they would have to be motivated to move him when it probably makes a whole lot more sense for them right now to move J.D. Davis. So we'll see. There's all going to be all kinds of things to shake out between now and opening day, which, gasp, is only like 3 weeks away. It feels like a really long time, Ben, but opening day nearly upon us. Looking forward to continuing to churn out podcasts between now and then.
Yeah, it's going to fly by. It really is. So, yeah, we'll see where the Jays are by the time we record next. We'll know a lot more, right? Because one way or another, even if they don't say anything, if Gausman and Manoah are not on the mound by the time we record sometime next week, that will tell us they are not in position to open the season healthy.
Oh, 100%. We found a way to get back to the dour, crushing reality of the way things have kind of turned for the Blue Jays so far in spring. But maybe things will turn back in a positive direction between now and the next time that we talk to you. Only time will tell. Gonna thank Sho Ali for stepping in for Christian Ryan as producer this week. Thanks so much to him. Listen to him on Jays Talk all year on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. For Ben Nicholson-Smith, I'm Arden Zwelling. We'll talk to you next time on At The Letters.